Hello and welcome to Before Brunch. I'm Megan Cassidy.
And I'm Cassie Delaney.
And we are your weekly celebrity gossip, news, arts, culture podcast. We go live on Sunday mornings.
Every week.
Every week.
Without fail.
Here we are, week two in a row.
There you go. And we usually talk about the things that your friends are going to be talking about at brunch before you go to brunch. So anything that's happened in pop culture, news, media. Lately, we've been covering a lot of media culture, which is kind of where our interests lie. Mm. And we're going to continue that this week by talking about what's going on with Netflix and also what is performing well in Ireland abroad and just the general scope of media.
Yeah, I think the Netflix story is obviously having global ripples across every industry. Yeah. It's just a real wake up call for everyone around, I don't know, what how businesses are valued, what it means when they free fall on the market. But it's certainly, in an Irish context, it's actually a great moment for TV and film. There's been lots of investment in Irish production companies. So the two are, it's kind of an odd juxtaposition.
Like, it is, it's
is
a funny
this the
one.
End of TV or...
Well, it's kind of like, is TV... I think what people are saying in the markets is, have we reached subscription fatigue? Mm. And is this going to be a return to TV? Like, are people going to start... unbundling their bundles and realize that TV is the best method of consuming content, which is interesting because obviously the streamers were a response to cable TV that was getting expensive, no on-demand services, and streaming became very popular because people were like, I want to choose what I watch and when, bundled everything together. The early days of Netflix, you could get your star catalog, you know, the kind of the overflow of content from TV stations went on Netflix, and that's why it was so appealing. But now we're in a totally different place.
So do you want to give the lay of the land, what happened with Netflix and why we're even having this conversation?
Exactly. So, well, there's a couple of things that have happened with Netflix this year. So in April, Netflix, for the first time in its 10-year reign, announced that it had dropped subscribers. So there's a couple of things that went on. So they had shed 200,000 subscribers in the first quarter of this year, which for Netflix was unheard of. It has been nothing but growth and growth and growth every year since its launch. So currently, you know, it has about 221 million subscribers. So it's still the market leader in the space, but... the 200,000 fall of subscribers is indicative of a bigger problem. So it, when Reed Hastings came out and announced the fall off of subscribers, also very pessimistically said they expect to lose up to 2 million subscribers in quarter two of this year. So we'll have those figures in June. Now, there's a couple of things that have happened there that have impacted the subscriber fall. Netflix have pointed to three big things. One is that they pulled out of Russia, and that was a loss of 700,000 subscribers. So actually they've gained 500,000 subscribers elsewhere in the world, and that net 200,000 loss is because of pulling out of Russia.
Yeah, I think people find that confusing, that it looks like they've lost 200,000 in Q1. They're forecasting 2 million in Q2. That's very stark.
Yeah.
But the 200,000 is net loss. So they did obviously gain subscribers as well. So it's a 200k net,
and
but they had forecasted to gain something like 2.5 million subscribers in Q1. So that's scary.
So this is the scary thing, right? So even though it's still the market leader, it startled a lot of people. And to this point, you know, the day after that announcement was made, the share value of Netflix dropped by 43%. It dropped by 20% the day after, which means that since December of 2021, the share value of Netflix has dropped by 43%, which is significant. We're seeing, like, that is a huge drop.
It's like
in a company.
$50 billion.
$50 billion was wiped out in one day of trading of its value, which is insane, like absolutely insane. And that has had repercussions to this week when they had to lay off 150 employees, mainly in the US. It represents about 2% of their 11,000 workforce. So not an insignificant amount of layoffs. A lot of creative heads were let go. Their animation department was particularly affected, and a lot of shows that were in the works were pulled. Now, the big shows, obviously Stranger Things and all that kind of stuff, is relatively unaffected, but their animation seems to be suffering. Their family children programming, I think, is going to suffer a lot. But it has shown a really interesting thing, because It's prompted a lot of conversations around subscriber fatigue and content fatigue. And is this the end of streaming? And is streaming going to continue on the downcline? And the short answer is that no, it's not. Streaming is still extremely popular. And as Netflix declines, we still are seeing an increase in Disney, Warner, Warner Brothers and Discovery, which is the kind of amalgamated platform from Time Warner and the Discovery Channel that was... there was a merger from 2021. So we're still seeing huge numbers of people turning to streaming as their, as their desired form of content consumption. Yeah. So the interesting thing here, I guess, is why is Netflix struggling? Why is Netflix performing so bad?
Yeah. And when you hear that they've made a creative cull, your initial reaction might be that, okay, so they're not investing in creative. And I think when we heard that, obviously, that the stock was in free fall and that they had a really bad fiscal call after Q1, then you see investors pulling out, like Bill Ackman, who is a billionaire investor and had plowed, I think he'd bought 3 million shares in the business or something, only 3 months previously. And his investment fund tend to make very predictable investments. They don't do a lot of risk. They like companies that are predictable and have very clear models. But they look at Netflix as a tech business.
Yeah.
And I suppose it is a tech business in that it's a data-driven product and they use algorithms.
Yeah.
And it's sort of part of this hustle culture, even the work culture would fit into what we would think of as a tech startup. But at the end of the day, Netflix is a movie studio.
Yeah.
And a TV network.
And that is the hill that I am willing to die on, is that Netflix is not a tech company. Netflix is a tech-enabled company. So when you think of tech companies versus tech-enabled companies, the easiest breakdown I always think of is a tech company sells you software, or it sells you software as a service, or it sells you hardware. It sells you tech.
Mm.
Whereas Netflix uses tech to sell you films and bad TV shows.
Right.
So I just think it's a tech-enabled company. I think that the issues it's having at the moment is because the market and investors and people are treating it like a tech company. And in tech, growth is everything. So the minute you sort of decline on growth, which they have done, that is when people start to pull out and panic. And they're like, this isn't going up and up and up. We're going to pull out our money. Loads of people tried to pull the money out of their shares. Obviously, Netflix is public. So there was a mass kind of exodus. People tried to pull their shares. The demand was super, super low. Price fell. It was just a mess,
yeah.
A total mess. And I just don't think you can think of Netflix. I think that the problem with Netflix is that it is a creative studio. They've always valued quantity over quality.
Yes.
And they've really moved far away from what they did in the early days.
Mm, as in their originals, their House of Cards?
Yeah. So House of Cards was a really big play for Netflix. So there was a couple of studios going after House of Cards for development. And Netflix went in there with a really high number and set a dangerous precedent for how much they were willing to pay for a top tier series.
Yeah.
So I think they went in with a $100 million budget, which was crazy at the time, just to secure it for Netflix. So they said, and if you look back on the kind of history of the Netflix model, when they first moved from DVD rentals into streaming, it worked because they amassed all of the excess content from other networks. So they took the backlog of content that was no longer shown on TVs that would otherwise just be sitting in kind of, an editing floor suites and stuff like that, going dormant, and they put it on a service where they could perpetually earn from it.
Yeah.
So when someone signed up to Netflix, they were met with maybe one or two great titles, but then they were finding hidden gems. They were finding, or nostalgic driven shows. So they were finding Dawson's Creek or Gossip Girl or, Bob's Burgers or whatever it was. They found these great shows that reminded them of their childhood. So they sticked around on Netflix. So they did. So they stuck around on Netflix. And it was of value at the time to the TV stations, to HBO, to Star, who were not in the streaming game, who were in the blockbuster theater theme park game, and that's where the majority of their income came from. So they didn't see a value in this backlog of content in the same way that Netflix did. And that's why they weren't, that's why they weren't afraid of Netflix. They didn't see it as a competitor or whatever. But as it became clear that this was how people liked to consume content and how Netflix trained people to consume content, the TV channels and the stations started coming in on it and building their own streamers.
Yeah.
And that's where the problem is, because then they started pulling their content away from Netflix. So Netflix, knowing that that would happen eventually, started investing in creating their own content or commissioning content from other creators. House of Cards, Orange is the New Black. And they, at the time, they commissioned content that you wouldn't see on TV stations, that nobody else wanted. You know, Stranger Things was famously turned down by a number of stations before it landed on Netflix and became one of their biggest shows. So they what they did at the start that they did really, really well was take content with diverse cast members, if you look at Orange is the New Black, strange, you know, sci-fi themes with Stranger Things, you know, short form star-studded shows, limited series, or documentary series with Making a Murderer. And these were all great plays that they made very early on that attracted people, that were the reason people signed up to Netflix. You wanted to watch House of Cards, you have to go to Netflix. There were some other hits that they had. When they took over, say, the back catalogue of Breaking Bad, they made that into, you know, a household name, where it had been running on TV for a number of years. So much so that I think in the season 4 finale of Breaking Bad, when it was solely on TV, it maybe attracted 2 million watchers. When it was, the back catalog was put on Netflix and the current season was running on TV, the finale gained 10 million viewers. So Netflix made stars of certain shows and did that really well, because it was a kind of the only place that people could watch things, or watch things in that bingey fashion.
Yeah.
So they weren't considerate of what would happen, I guess, when the likes of Disney Plus or Prime or HBO Max caught up with them very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And had their legacy brands. And this is something that Netflix just does not do. It is not building legacy programming. Stranger Things, yes, but it has nowhere near the following, the loyalists that the Marvel Universe has, or, you know, any, like Prime probably isn't really doing it either, building the legacy stuff, but that is, or Disney. Disney builds legacy programming. You know what you get from a Disney Pixar animation. You know you're going to get a family favorite thing. Netflix needs to start thinking of the long game stuff like that.
Yeah, like as I listen to you talk, it's just so simply a content problem, a creative problem. We have a market obsession with annual growth, which is not sustainable for a business like Netflix unless you have hits. It just, you just need a hit after a hit after a hit. And we know that streamers favor TV. Feature film just doesn't tend, certainly original feature film doesn't tend to do the same numbers on streamers. And Netflix, while it's had such amazing success in TV, and even if you look at the last year, they acquired Squid Games, like incredible. Bridgerton was huge. Euphoria. They've had success after success on the TV side of the business, but that's 50% of
their Euphoria business. Was HBO Max.
Oh, excuse
me. So you can't go, like HBO, you cannot touch with their programming.
Yeah, that's like, just a mistake on
No, but like they just, nobody does it like HBO. And this is the thing that everyone is realizing now about Netflix. First of all, to take the point that like it's, we're obsessed with the growth and you can't, you cannot judge Netflix on its year-on-year growth. Netflix product, when you break it down, is its content.
Yeah.
And that content is ever changing. Like there's so many viables in their product. There's so many changing things all the time that to treat it like something that should be on a sustainable upward curve seems insane to me. Like the fact that it has so many backers and so many investors seems crazy, because traditionally investors will not go near media businesses because of that problem, because you have to constantly be on top of your game. You're only as good as your last series. You're only as good as your last blockbuster.
Yeah.
And so the fact that Netflix is now succumbing to this pressure and then now having to build data-driven programming is just a recipe for disaster.
That's it. And like Bill Ackman put his finger on it. He was like, look, Netflix are now moving towards advertising. Mm-hmm. They're chasing customers who aren't paying. They're chasing non-subscriptions, like similar to the Spotify model. And that is less predictable. But that's always been this business. It's a media business. It's less predictable than they originally thought. And he's saying, you know, it makes sense for Netflix. It does not make sense for my portfolio. And that was the mistake that was made. If you look at the movies that Netflix have created, like the budgets that they spend on movies, the model is very tricky because you've got this upfront payment, mm-hmm. you've no back end that you would have had for a movie studio in a theater whereby there's box office afterwards. Yeah. It's all an upfront outlay. They're spending something like, oh God, I don't want to put a figure on it, $100 million on The Gray Man this year.
Yeah, so their budget, their content budget for the year is billions.
Yeah.
Like it's $40 billion or something for this year alone. And they're doing about $25 billion in revenue. Mm. But using that in such a, like, the flip of a coin.
It's hit or miss. Yeah. It's a risk. And you're paying these actors up front. There is no box office.
Yeah.
It's a completely different model. So the model is a tech business, a subscription business, a product. But you've got the flip side where you need the content to back that up. And
exactly. And good content comes down to good people. And those people are moving freely around all the streamers are moving around the different studios. And you have these relationships between different studios, actors, you know, directors like to work with certain actors, certain directors like to work with certain studios, studios like to work with different distributors. It's incredibly hard to break down those things. Traditionally, tech has not disrupted Hollywood at all. Hollywood is like a closed elite circle that has performed well, you know, over the years, and it's very, very hard to break into. So the fact that Netflix has managed to be successful to this point is surprising. But I think that when we look at the whole Netflix problem, what's going on with the market, I think it's very specific to Netflix. Mm. It's not something that's impacting Disney Plus. Apple TV have had an incredible year. They won the Oscar for the best film, you know? And Apple TV's growth is significant, but they do things completely differently to Netflix. It's like they've learned from Netflix's mistake.
And they don't spend half the budget that Netflix do on content, which is really interesting.
They don't spend half the budget, but also when you watch something on Apple TV, first of all, released weekly, it's annoying, but like, you stick around with your subscription because you want to see the next episode of The Shining Girls with, you know, who's in it? Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. They're investing in really good quality actors, great scripts, really good programming, or acquiring programming that really fits a cohesive theme. Like when you watch an Apple TV show, you know it's an Apple TV show. They have this very like deep, rich sort of style of content, very dramatic, top names, really, really good quality programming.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's, yeah, I'm going to stick with Apple TV. Same kind of with Disney Plus. What they have going for them, I guess, is their back catalogue of stuff, their legacy brands, the commitment, and then HBO Max. You just cannot compete with their level of content because they're a legacy brand. They're part of Warner Time. They are the best in the biz. But also I think what's really interesting and why potentially, you know, Disney and Apple TV aren't being talked about in the same way that Netflix is because when you look at the Disney and Apple balance sheets, streaming doesn't even really come onto it because they have other things to lean back on.
Yeah.
You know, like despite the success of Disney Plus, they've got their theme parks.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to have their money. Apple TV have, you know, Apple. So they're fine. They're always going to be fine. And maybe that's what Netflix's problem is that it's solely content.
It's also funny that like Apple win best feature film for Coda at the Oscars this year.
Which Netflix, is a grand film.
Oh yeah. Netflix have yet to win. Like Netflix are being shunned by the Academy at this point. And because they were disruptors in the industry, it's almost like they've been kind of the scapegoats for the blame around the state of cinema today and the fact that people don't go to cinemas anymore, that they're all at home streaming. And Apple is kind of sneaking in behind them doing the same thing, but accepted by the Academy. You know, like Netflix will be hoping for an Emmy this year, probably for Bridgerton. They're up against Severance on Apple TV. And you can be pretty sure that the Academy, there's just this general idea that Netflix is to blame for everything, but an acceptance of the Apples, the HBOs, the in that kind of movie industry circle.
Yeah, and I guess maybe it's that HBO has that history of creating top tier content. Mm. Apple doesn't, but I think Apple are a lot quieter about what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, they're just around, they're not amassing other people's content. Mm. They're commissioning things slowly. They're creating really good stuff. They're putting it up there as a weekly service. And they're not encouraging this kind of like binge all you can and then move on to something else. They're not encouraging this quantity consumption in the same way that Netflix are. Like Netflix, Reed Hastings basically said they will continue making crap content because they know people will watch it. Mm. Netflix are also notoriously quiet about their numbers and performance unless they want to shout about something. So like with, say, Bird Box, they were like 80 million people watch this in 1 week. They don't traditionally release their figures. They don't have to because of the nature of the business. The back catalog content is perpetually earning. It's never considered a loss, so it doesn't matter how it performs. Mm. But they, you know, Reed Hastings said they will continually make stuff about shit vampires or, you know, teenage dramas that go nowhere because they know that people can watch them and they also control how people watch them. So they will push them up to the top of your feed. Mm. One of the really interesting things about Netflix, I don't think a lot of people know, is they dynamically change the cover art of things based on your consumption habits.
I felt that because I will always get served Claire Underwood. Well, that would probably happen. Sorry, that's a bad example. No, because
but you probably did beforehand get Claire Underwood before you got Kevin Spacey.
Yes.
The same with a lot of the content. I'm obviously like as an LGBT person will see LGBT characters featured on the screen, or will see my homepage reflect my viewing habits just to keep me on it. And that's interesting. I mean, when that works, it works really well. Serve me more of what I enjoy and stop making me browse for stuff. Mm. I will be happy and stick around on this platform more.
Yeah, but they just don't have the sticky content
anymore.
They
don't, no.
Certainly on the movie side. Then how does that play out closer to home? So Ireland spends, I think we invest 600 million, sorry, not that we invest, consumers, Irish consumers are spending 600 million on streamers a year, but not getting that investment back into local production from these streamers. So there's a little bit of sort of, okay, Netflix, now's your comeuppance, you know. Yeah. You need to help and invest in the local talent that's creating the work for you, that is the source of your your value is your content. So, you know, industry reps are actually, you know, calling on the government to introduce a content levy on these streamers so that they have to invest a certain amount of the cash that they're
earning back
into local productions, which I think is a
phenomenal idea. Because when you look at what's performing really well for Irish programming, you've got the likes of Derry Girls, which is an international sensation. They've been referenced in The Simpsons, you know.
Incredible.
You don't get more fame than
that. Can we call that an Irish production? See that?
But see, we've got Irish talent who are having to go abroad to get Irish programming made. Irish programming made, written by Irish people about Ireland and Irish history, having to be made by British broadcasters because of the way the things are. I mean, it's a good complaint to have. There's too many talented people working in film in Ireland who are struggling to get the funding that they require to get the deals or to get stuff made on an international level, except when it comes to the likes of Normal People or Conversations with Friends, made by the same production team in Element Pictures, but in association. Normal People was in association with BBC Three and Hulu. Conversations with Friends is in association with BBC Three and RTE.
Yeah, and these co-productions make a lot of sense for these businesses. You know, you can share the costs, you can increase budgets because of these co-productions. But it's, you know, Ireland has had a really entrepreneurial relationship with film and TV, and like Element Pictures was founded in 2001 by Ed Gainey.
Yeah.
Fantastic man, Ed. And it's a great indicator of how much this sector is on the up, because there's been a deal done recently with Fremantle, which is a huge UK production that have taken a majority stake in Element. That is an indication that this is a sector on the rise.
Absolutely. And Irish film has always performed really well. You know, you look at
Kenneth Branagh.
Kenneth Branagh. was up for the Oscar for Belfast, you know. We have incredible talent as well. We're seeing, and we see a lot of Irish talent behind the scenes in Netflix and Apple TVs. I know particularly Apple TV invests quite heavily in using Irish stunt staff in their productions, which is brilliant. But yeah, it's a real shame that we're not seeing that return from Netflix. Netflix content is still very heavily American.
Yeah, certainly. And I think we've got so many of the raw materials here. Yeah. We've got this creativity and storytelling, and our creative talent is incredible, but we've also got incredible scenery, like we've had Game of Thrones,
but great tax breaks as well for filming in Ireland.
Well, it's a fantastic place to film financially, and we, you know, the, what is it, section 481, you know, the one, the section 481, it's incredibly attractive financially to film in Ireland and to co-produce and to invest here. And we've just got, you know, look at Nicola Coughlan and Bridgerton.
A little star, like
Jamie Beamish of Waterford Man, lives just around the corner from me, Jamie, the top Doran of the town. He's in Bridgerton. Yeah. And it's great to see... Sorry, we have a producer now, so this is the first time we've had a third party in the room, so I'm like being really unprofessional. Anytime he reacts, I'm just looking, trying to see what he thinks. What do you think, for
you impressed?
Yeah, thumbs up.
You dropped a name and you got it. Yeah,
need approval. So we're seeing them on the global stage, and obviously we have, if in this conversation we have to talk about Sally Rooney.
Yeah, I mean, there's not been a more collective cultural moment as people reading Conversations with Friends and watching Normal People during the pandemic. Like, let's talk about event TV. That was Normal People, and that was released on, you know, regular TV week by week, and people consumed it and everyone was talking about it. You know, water cooler moments, or the Zoom equivalent of water cooler moments, all over the world. Everyone was tuned into that. There is something, it's hard to put your finger on what works with Irish content and Irish writing, because you've got Sally Rooney as like the head, you've got her at the top of the triangle, but then you have great stuff from Megan Nolan, Louise Nealon, you know, even Louise O'Neill, all these amazing female writers in and around the same genre, working on very, very similar things, all with their own independent success, because there's such an appetite for that sort of wistful, almost love, almost romance story that I think Irish writers do very well, because, to quote Sally Rooney, we're very normal people, and it's not sensationalized. It's not cheesy LA Hollywood love stories. You've got these beautiful human sort of stories.
That's why this moment is good news from every angle. It's the Irish disproportionate success on a global stage, and Finn McRedmond wrote in the Irish Times about how Sally Rooney has created a zeitgeist and internationally. But it's also the fact that it's romance as a genre, which is, you know, targeted at women, considered female interest and therefore kind of shunned. Now we've got the Bridgertons, you know, being considered for an Emmy, which, you know, historically hasn't. Romance is usually not a huge contender when you're up against sci-fi and psychological thrillers. And we've got Bridgerton. But that's the beauty of the Sally Rooney moment, is all of the authors you mentioned there are female. And a lot of it is romance and this universal, you know, story, which is sex.
Yeah, there's a lot of sex.
There's a lot of it.
But there's a lot of like...
It's not quaint, though, anymore.
There's a lot of like... I don't know. I think they just all, it's that all the stories resonate very well with people.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this very average love stories, which is funny because it's so reflective of the Irish experience of growing up in your teens and like not falling in love, that it's, to us, it's like, oh yeah, this is like reading a diary. Obviously not reading a diary. It's very talented. Yeah. They're all very talented writers, but it's very close to the bone for us, but it has been somewhat romanticized around the rest of the world, you know. Like, I read a piece that was like, if you were on a beach in LA in 2020, the likelihood was that you had a copy of Conversations with Friends.
Exactly. And it's a different conversation now. I was reading an American blog about Normal People, and the observation was, you know, the Irish people ask questions without an inflection at the end of their sentence. And I was like, well, that's an observation that's very different to that like really twee, quaint idea of Irishness. And we all saw Emily Blunt's Wild Mountain Thyme
ad. I never watched it.
We didn't see the movie, we saw the ad. And this idea of Irishness that is obviously so dated and not true, whereas Sally Rooney and her ilk are putting forward, as Finn McRedmond says, a more contemporary Ireland, a more contemporary Dublin, where the conversation isn't about the Irishness anymore. It's about the story, the feelings, because they're so real, so universal. And Paul Mescal is so beautiful.
Yeah. But I mean, I've even put Ga shorts on the global stage. It's funny to watch and think that's so, you know, so normal to us and so understandable, and to see the world react. But I do feel a sense of pride. It's like when you see the Pillow Queens go off to, you know, do James Corden in the US. There is this sense of pride when I see an Irish artist or an Irish woman perform well on the international stage. Even,
of course.
Even Aisling B. And I feel like I know them personally. Like, if I were to meet someone abroad and they were like, have you heard of Aisling B? I'd be like, I know her. She's my friend.
But that would be a lie though, Cassie, wouldn't it?
It would be a lie. Yeah, it'd be a total lie.
Yeah.
But I just feel that way because of the sense of pride I feel. Same with the Pillow Queens. Know them well. Best pals.
Right. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Wasn't aware.
Yeah. No, I'd be like, they are my friends and they perform well in the States. Did you see them on James Corden? It's just something fantastic. It's the only thing I can describe it as is how straight men must feel about sport.
Okay, I saw a great tweet during the week that like straight men love sport because it's a chance for them all to get together and sing songs.
Yeah.
Like they get to sing songs together.
And there's nothing like a group harmony. I mean, they don't harmonize, but like wait till they do.
Yeah.
You'll never get them out of the pub.
Yeah. But it is that togetherness. And like because Ireland is seen as the underdog, it fosters that us versus them, like competitiveness that, you know, is always good creative fuel.
It is. So we look at the whole, I suppose, media landscape at the moment. And the broad questions out there are, what is going to survive? What is going to work? Is TV having a resurgence? Are streamers dead? Has TV killed the streamer star? I think the answer is
that was pre-prepared.
That was 10 years.
Had to have been
scripted. No, it came off the top of my head.
Did TV kill the streamer star? Is not written on your laptop. You're telling me it's not written on your laptop.
No, Irish TV and how it performs globally. Derry Girls getting rave reviews. Lisa McGee. That's what's written there. Netflix, to summarize, is too broad and confused by its identity. Jesus.
Okay. You practiced that line earlier, but it's okay.
I didn't actually. I've been very busy.
Okay.
No,
it was great off the cuff then.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's all it takes.
Congrats.
All right, Megan. So to look at things broadly, back to the point at hand, what is going to happen in the media landscape? I think the problem with the streamers is treating Netflix like a tech company, to summarize, and expecting that massive growth from Netflix. It just means it's too confused. Data-driven programming is not going to work. The thing that works, and to quote you, I don't know if you came up with this, but I always attribute this to you in my head.
Oh, yes, whatever it is.
Is the tastemakers.
Oh my God, I did not come up with the word tastemakers.
Okay, well you did an interview about it and you used the word a lot. So I was like,
Megan, did I say that? Oh my God, I did.
You did. You talked about tastemakers versus trend setters.
Do you know what? Maybe I did come up with
you
it.
Might
that
have.
Was an interview I did in the Irish Mirror.
Well done to you.
Yeah. Think makers, no? Think leaders.
Think leaders. Think influencers.
That's the word that I came up with.
Sorry, it is.
I can coin thinkfluencer. I did not come up with tastemaker, which is a ubiquitous term all around the world.
Straight down your camera, wasn't it?
No, I was looking at the producer.
Land that point home.
I was looking at Ferg for
backup.
What
an idiot. What a fool. Back to the point. Netflix needs to become more of the thinkfluencer, the leader, and to stop following the data and to give people what they don't know they want yet. To go back to what they did when they gave us Orange is the New Black and Stranger Things and Making a Murder and give us the things that don't make sense that we fall in love with. If they keep serving us the stuff that has worked on the platform, it's going to get really banal and boring. So I think that Netflix is just having an identity crisis.
Yeah.
Needs to stop with the quantity over quality, focus on what it does well, understand that it's a content business and it's a studio, and continue to make great content. Netflix, as a streamer, as a business, is still a totally viable business. It's doing $25 billion a year. That is no joke. It's under pressure because it's a public company, but it still can, you know, it can still thrive. And the reality of it is everyone in this room, none of us are going to cancel our Netflix accounts.
That was my next question to you. Have you ever considered unsubscribing? Because
no.
It hasn't crossed my mind. And even with that new pop-up notification, you know, prices are going up after obviously their Q1. I couldn't
tell you what they are. And I know they've gone up twice over the last year, but you just kind of keep doing it.
And who is unsubscribing? Like, is it people that are watching for the backlogs, for The Office,
well,
for Friends, for, and when those shows go, they go too.
A lot of unsubscribers are coming from geos that have been hit really badly since the pandemic, where the cost of living is going right up. So they're losing a lot of UK subscribers particularly. But I'd say that they're not actually losing subscribers. They're losing accounts and people are still watching on shared subscriptions. Which is an issue and something that they're trying to address as well, is eliminating the password sharing.
Yes.
So how they do that is difficult, because the great thing about Netflix is the mobility of it. That I watch Netflix when I go to the UK or when I'm, you know, wherever else.
Well, so my how sister, do they for the first time, got a notification last week to say that there's too many logins and she can't watch it from her device. And I had to log out from wherever I was. Even though I have a Netflix account, but password sharing is part of Netflix culture.
I love going onto Netflix and seeing everyone's profiles.
Yeah.
You know, and I click in and see what dad's watching and then get any recommendations.
And like you said, it's so personalized. It's such a singular experience.
Yeah.
Like if I log into Hannah's Netflix
account. And there was a day when you'd be like, I don't want people to log into my Netflix history and see what I've been watching.
But not even your history. Like, you can see who you are from your algorithm, 100%. What it's serving you. Like, Hannah just loves high school, like young adult
dramas,
which there is a moment
happening.
But it's so obvious. I feel like mine is, I don't know, a little bit. I like the, no, I'm not going to say it.
Tense dramas. I mean, mine's just like all murder and killers and stuff. But there's a lot of like started things and half finished things. Mm. So I think, Netflix just needs to focus on what it does right and do it and continue to do it with, like, ignoring the pressure that's coming from the talk and the chatter in the markets, because it is viable and it will continue to stabilize. Unfortunately, stability is not sexy in the tech world. So I think that share prices will continue to be affected with that tech mindset.
Mm.
Disney Plus will continue to thrive. It's doing great. And Apple TV, I think, will only go strength to strength. But I do think we'll start to see a resurgence with TV, because I think the more we invest, the more we, I suppose, go into different streamers, the more customary watching things weekly is becoming again.
Do you mean TV as a format or TV as in like cable TV?
I think cable TV.
Wow.
Yeah, I think that we're starting to see a lot of really good programming. When you look at Conversations with Friends and normal people being on cable TV, or what else is, see, the Sky Atlantic programming.
Yeah.
That's really good. You obviously have it on Sky On Demand, but it's different to streaming services. That's on, you know, regular TV. And then you have your cultural TV programs coming back again, your TV moments, your Love Islands, your Bake Off, Sewing Bee, all those great shows that people get just great comfort in watching weekly and scheduling those into their sort of weekly lives again. I think the volume and the massive growth we saw over the last 2 years was because people were locked in their houses.
Yeah.
But now people are back into their routines. Tuesday evening at 9 p.m., I'm going to stick on Normal People or whatever time, or Conversations with Friends. Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Sewing Bee is on.
There is something so comforting about that linear model. And like, even Virgin Media Ireland had Smother this year. Sunday night, total cure for the fear. Fantastic script, fantastic setting. Did you watch Smother?
No, but I the thing is, once I miss one that's on the TV, this is the problem.
Oh,
hard to get it. Do you know? I know it's on the iPlayer, but you watch things, or the RTE player. I like to watch things, you know, with Lydia, with my partner, or at home with my family. So I'm not going to sit down and watch the RTE player on my own.
But it's very funny, because if you look at the likes of Smother, right, you miss Smother, you miss episode one. Even the creation of those programs that are seeded out weekly, it's such a different development because it's episodic, and you have to remember that people might not have watched the last episode half an hour beforehand, and it doesn't lend itself to a binge the same way that the TV that's created to binge does. Yes.
I mean, there's great tropes in the TV that's created to binge, is that last 30 second cliffhanger. Oh, I need to watch the next 2 minutes of the next one. And then you're in and you're in and you're in and you're in.
Mm.
It's creating TV for consumption, mm, as opposed to the, you know, the episodic creation, where I think it's just creating, it just lends itself to better content, even though it's interrupted often by ads. It's creating better content because it is focusing on the arcs of the story, and piece by piece by piece we're putting this together, as opposed to how do we create 10 hours of TV that people are going to watch in one go.
Yeah. So Netflix needs to revisit how it's creating TV. They need to obviously cut costs, so we'll probably be looking at shorter series.
Shorter series, but lower budget stuff.
Lower,
you
know, budget, yeah.
I think they've thrown lots of money into high budget things and big names that hasn't worked.
Yeah, good stories.
Yeah, good stories. Come over to Ireland, hang around a few coffee shops, you'll find the next Sally Rooney, and you can create something very, very special on a low budget in Dublin.
Sorted. Give Reed a call.
There you go.
What are we talking about next week, Cathy?
If I had my way, we'd be talking about the media again, but we
media?
Will.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, no, it's a good one for us. Yeah. We might. You know what I am interested in talking about a little bit more on this series is general. We do it well. Is the general.
We do it well.
The creator landscape and what's going on. There's been a lot of talk recently about unhappy employees coming out of TikTok.
Yeah. And the TikTok work culture has really been blown up.
Yeah. So what's going on there? Our ever-changing world where culture meets tech. That's where I like to.
Sounds beautiful.
That's where I like to be.
That's where you like to live, exist.
That's it.
Okay. Yeah. I can't wait. I'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks, Ferg.